This is Mame Warren. Today is the 4th of May, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia with William Hill, who I'm real excited to be talking to. All right. What drew you here in the first place? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. Went to the public schools there. Actually born and grew up in the city as opposed to one of the suburbs like most people do.
So why Washington and Lee?
My dad was always adamant about his kids going to college. He had 7 sons and 2 daughters. I was the oldest. And my baby brother was born my senior year in high school, but he wanted us to all go to college. And there was no doubt in my mind that if I was going to go to college, I had to leave Atlanta. I could not stay in the city and go to school. My friends were ending up everywhere except in school. Most of them ended up in jail or doing time. And when I got ready to go to school, I applied to colleges, generally up and down the Eastern Seaboard. My dad and I visited schools, and I got scholarships to several schools. My dad was adamant. He wanted me to attend Emory, but I didn't want to go to Emory because I wanted to leave home. He said if he had to pay for me to go to school, I was going to go where he wanted to go. And I said, well, what if I got scholarships? He said, you can go anywhere you want to go. So we visited schools, and on the way back through, we stopped in Virginia to see W&L. I had gotten accepted here and gotten a scholarship at W&L. And as soon as I set foot on campus, I turned to my dad and I said, this is where I'm going to school. That was it. I didn't look at another college.
Why?
I don't know. It was just something about the school. As soon as when we parked over in front of the co-op and we walked across in front of the president's house, walking toward the colonnade, and at the time I didn't know it was the president's house, but I knew the admissions office was over in Washington Hall. I had been told that by some students out front. And as we were walking toward the colonnade, just looking at the campus, I knew this is where I wanted to go. Felt like home.
Did you realize that you were going to be in the first class of black students?
Yeah, I did. And I had a substantial lack of appreciation for what that meant. They say ignorance is bliss. It truly is. Ignorance really is bliss. And the problem was I grew up in an all-black neighborhood. I went to an all-black high school. I never sat in the classroom with a white kid until I was a freshman at W&L. Never had a white teacher until I was a freshman at W&L. And I had no appreciation for what culture shock really would be. And maybe if I had had an appreciation for it, I would have perceived W&L differently. I'm glad I didn't have an appreciation for it. And I didn't truly get confronted with it until I was in my first year here and in a substantial number of my classes. I was the only black person in the whole class.
Tell me about that.
It was a little unnerving. I mean, you're 18 years old, and the problem with being 18 is you think you know everything. And then when I got here, I thought I had gotten a good education in the public school system in Atlanta. And my teachers were constantly telling us that we weren't getting the best education we could get. And I can remember I worked for a cleaning service my senior year in high school, for Oxford Cleaning Service. And we used to clean other high schools. And in my biology class, Ms. McLeod had us to go down to the Georgia State bookstore, and we had to buy the biology texts we were using because she couldn't get them for us from the Atlanta City school system. Yet one evening we were cleaning the biology lab over at Thurl High, which was all white. And Thurl High had stacked in their biology lab the textbooks we had to go down to Georgia State bookstore to buy. And they were all stamped Atlanta City school system. So I kind of understood what she was saying. But I understood it even more when I got to W&L, because a lot of the guys in my class, they weren't smarter than I was, but they had a better educational foundation than I did. And I'd find myself up at night reading to catch up. And for a lot of these guys, freshman year at W&L for them was review with very little new information. A lot of it was just review. And they partied. They had a good time. They were out on weekends. I was in the library working my butt off just trying to make C's. And I mean, so the academic pressures were horrendous. And then there were only a handful of black guys here. A guy named Leslie Smith had graduated from law school in June of 1970. And his brother, Bobby, was in my class as a freshman undergrad in September of 1970. Well, Leslie went to work for the Justice Department. They found him stabbed to death in his apartment in D.C. during the summer. And there were two black guys in undergrad here, Walter Blake and Linwood Smothers, and they both lived here in Lexington. They, to my knowledge, were the first two black people to ever graduate from the undergrad. They graduated in 72. So my class was, there was Walter and Linwood in the class of 72. There were no black students in the class of 73 or the class before them of 71. And in my class, the class of 74, I think they had like 9 or 10 or 11, maybe as many as 12 or 13 of us. Most of us made it through. Some of us didn't. So the social pressures were different too. I mean, it was the first time I found myself in an educational environment like that. And just little things. I mean, you go over to the cockpit, and this was before Saturday Night Fever, so the BGs were not big in the black neighborhood. I mean, we just didn't get into the BGs. And you go over to the cockpit, and they play music on the machine over there, and they had no black music. And the only black music they did have were old Motown music from the 60s, what they call beach music. So that was tough. And then WNL was an all-male campus, which I knew when I came. And the surrounding girls' schools were like WNL. I mean, Hollins had maybe 9 black women, maybe 10. Mary Baldwin had 6 or 7. Sweetbriar was just as bad. And just because there were 8 black women in Hollins didn't mean one of them was going to like you. So I mean, that was different. Although I ended up marrying a woman who went to Hollins, my wife. Went to Hollins. I met her my junior year. She was a freshman in Hollins. So it was different. Academically, it was a challenge, and socially, it was a challenge. We drew a lot of support from each other because, unlike the black student population now, most of us came from all black environments. We didn't grow up in integrated neighborhoods or go to integrated schools, so we were kind of different from the black student body population now. We were hungry. A lot of us were very hungry. We saw
Tell me what you mean by that.
We weren't here at WNL because our daddies went to WNL, or because our granddaddies went to WNL. We were here at WNL because we saw WNL as an opportunity to make our lives better, to get out of the old neighborhood, not as part of the ritual of growing up. You go through WNL, you come back home, you work in your daddy's business. I mean, we didn't do that. I mean, it was like you go to WNL, this is your opportunity to try and acquire a key to open doors that ordinarily you wouldn't have access to. So we saw WNL in that sense. So it was real important to us to try and do well at WNL, not just be here marking time.
Did all the people you started with finish?
Not all of them, no. Most of us did. Maybe we lost 2 or 3 along the way.
And people who were lost, was it for academic reasons or social reasons?
I think it was for academic reasons more than anything else.
Take me into the classroom. Tell me what it feels like to walk in and be the only black student in the classroom. What was the reception from the faculty? What was the reception from the students?
It all depended upon which classroom you were walking into. If you walked into one of the classrooms, say in sociology department, or the English department, or the history department. I always found those to be extremely receptive departments. You walk into a sociology class, and I think in the beginning I was more aware of being the only black person in there than they were. They were aware, but I was more concerned about being the only black person in there than they were concerned about me being the only black person in there. I think back on it, and I think the professors saw it as a unique opportunity for them to teach a minority student and try and learn something in the process. For a vast majority of the student body population, it didn't mean anything one way or the other. I mean, they were more apathetic than anything else. The only students you, as a minority student, the only students you had problems with were a small minority of students who were adamant in their belief that minority students shouldn't be on campus. Most of the students didn't care one way or the other because they weren't here to focus on the issue of minority students on campus. That's not why they were here. So the vast majority of students, it was a non-issue. Now, some of your professors were slow to warm to the idea of blacks on campus, as they were slow to warm to the idea of women on campus. The law school went co-ed in 72 when I was a junior, and then when I started in law school in 74, the women were still having a difficult time in the law school. Well, you know, the experience that the women were having their first year at law school, which was a culture shock for them coming from co-educational environments, coming to W&L's law school, which was only recently co-educational, they were shocked and taken aback by the subtle forms of discrimination. And for me, I mean, it was old hat by then. I mean, the subtle forms, so long as it doesn't hurt me, I don't care about it. But it was somewhat amusing to see how white females reacted to truly feeling as if they were being discriminated against for the first time in an educational environment. All of a sudden, they became more sensitive to what it felt like to be a minority at W&L. So you had a natural commonality of responses over in the law school. Well, in the undergrad, I'd be in class sometimes. Like I had one biology professor. We finish our gym class. There were three or four of us in the same gym class, and we literally have to run over to the other side of the campus once we finish showering. And we would get there, and I can remember many occasions getting there, and there'd be three of us coming in late. All three of us would come in and sit down, and I would be the only one. He would say, "Hill, why are you late?" And I said, "Well, doctor, so-and-so, I'm just getting out of gym." He says, "That's not my problem. You need to be here on time." And I'm not going to turn and say, "Well, I just walked in with John and Tom, and you're not on them." And he never would. He just jumped my butt every damn time I'd come in late. And we used to get extra credit for class participation. And I would participate in class. Never got extra credit. If my grade hovered between a B and a C, an extra credit would push me over to a B. I didn't get a B. And I can remember one Christmas, he gave out hard candy in the classroom. I was the only black person in the classroom. He gave everybody else hard candy, gave me a pack of Tootsie Rolls.
Who was this?
I can't remember his name right now. If I found an old course curriculum, I could give it to you. I don't know if he's still down there or not, taught in the biology department. Gave me a pack of Tootsie Rolls. And so what am I going to do? I'm going to go complain to him about getting a C. You know what happens? I went back and talked to him one time about my grades, and he was going through my test paper. He said, "Mr. Hill, you know, I'm glad you came back to discuss your exam with me. I see certain things on your exam I missed the first time. I'm surprised I gave you as much credit for this particular answer as I did." And I'm sitting there, and he says, "You think we ought to continue this discussion?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Take your paper and go." I said, "Yes, sir." I never went back to discuss a grade with another professor after that. You learn the rules of engagement.
Did you feel that the same thing would happen if you talked to other people? Or was that just so frightening?
No, I'm not so sure the same thing would happen, but I figured I'd give it my best shot the first time up, and whatever I got, that was it. I wasn't going to go back and ask a professor to change my grade, and I never did. Even if I felt I had been graded on the low side, graded more harshly, I never went back again and talked to another professor about my grade. Not because I felt intimidated by the other professors, and I don't want to give the impression that everybody at W&L was like that, because they were not. As a matter of fact, the administration was bending over backwards to try and make the black students feel comfortable on campus. About, well, I guess maybe 13, maybe 14 years ago, I was back on campus. Dr. Hodges publishes on, I think, a quarterly basis this booklet on law, medicine, and business, ethics in law, medicine, and business. And he invited me to come up and speak, and he invited John Morrison. And Morrison and I were in undergrad here together, and we were also in law school together. And Morrison is a circuit court judge in Portsmouth now. Well, this was before either one of us got on the bench. Morrison was the Commonwealth's attorney, and I was the director of the criminal division in the State Attorney General's office. And we both came back up here to speak on ethics and law. And I was talking to President Huntley. And I said, "You know, President Huntley, I look back on it, and I, I recall some of the things we did when we were here on campus. Like one time the black students got bent out of shape because President Huntley would not agree to let us have first choice for rooms in the old Spee House down below the post office, the house with the red door. They had all gotten kicked out of the house and they were opening up the student housing. And this was at the end of our freshman year. And we said, next year when we move off campus, can black students have first access for housing in that house? And he says, well, you know, you just have to take your turn like everybody else. So we had started a black student union, and the university wouldn't fund our black student union, so we had a sit-in over in President Huntley's office, probably all eight of us. And they just stepped over us all day long, going back and forth to work. I mean, just like we weren't there. I mean, we sat down, we read, and we studied in the floor, and they just walked all over us. And around 4:30, 4 to 5, they closed up shop, and everybody left, and we were just sitting there. And it was getting close to dinner time, and we always wanted to watch the news before we ate dinner. And so finally we said to each other, you guys think maybe we all are going over to the dining hall now? So we got up and walked out. But we were back for the seminar, and I was recalling that experience, and I said, you know, President Huntley, sometime if I had been you guys, I'd have lost patience with us. And Huntley said, well, we saw something in you all. And I said, well, do you think you were right? He says, well, here we are years later, you're standing here on campus talking to me, aren't you? And so I said, well, I guess you're right. I guess you're right. Maybe he saw something in us we didn't see. But the administration was bending over backwards trying to make us feel comfortable on campus. They were making, I guess, honest faux pas because they didn't have a common basis for communication. And we didn't have a common basis for communication other than they wanted to give us a good education and we wanted to get a good education. That first year we had a Black Culture Weekend, and the university wouldn't fund us. We called Doug Wilder up on the telephone. He was a young representative in Big Fro. And we asked Representative Wilder, would he come down and speak in Lee Chapel at our Black Culture Weekend? And he said yes. And the only thing we could do was we could buy his gas. We had to scrape together the money. We bought his gas down and back, and we bought him dinner. And he came down and spoke at our first Black Culture Weekend. And we ran into the hole on that, and the university bailed us out. And so then university said they were going to fund us to a small degree, and they did. And we spent more than they gave us. So the next year they gave us a little bit more, and the next year they gave us a little bit more. And that's how we started our Black Student Union, which was SABU. It was the Student Association for Black Unity. One night we were sitting around studying for exams, and I said, you know, we need a patch. So I designed a patch that we were going to put on the back of our denim jackets. It was red, black, and green with red letters, SABU, on a green background with a black border, and down in the bottom in cursive in white was Washington Lee University. I still got one of the patches at home in my bottom drawer. Never been put on a jacket, still in pristine condition. We had those produced in 1972. I still got my old jacket with the one sewn on the back of it, too.
You have any pictures of yourself on it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would love to see those.
I'll find one. If you get the 1974 yearbook, you can see us all sitting out on the front porch of the house that we lived in right across the street from the funeral home.
Do you have the original of that? Do you have a print?
I've got a print of it at home. We got.
See, I can't use what's in the yearbook. I have to work from an original photograph.
I've got the original black and white photograph at home.
Great. If you could loan us that, Patrick will copy it and we'll get the original back again.
I'll do that. We got we used to get these little white cards from the administration, got it from Dean John. I got one, Hutch got one, Penn got one, and it said, Dean John would like to see you in his office at 8:15. I go, damn. So did you get one of these too? And Penn would say, Dean John would like to see you in his office at 8:30. And then Hutch says, Dean John would like to see you in his office at 8:45. So I get over there to see what Dean John wanted, and he wanted us to take another yearbook photograph. He didn't want the yearbook to be published with that photograph in it, so we went and take another yearbook photograph. And that's how that photograph ended up in the yearbook.
What was his problem with it?
I don't know. I guess we could have done better. But we were late taking a photograph. They kept trying to get us together, and we were never in one place at one time. And we had all just walked back over from class, and the photographer was sitting on the porch waiting on us. And he said, "I need to get you guys photographs." So we said, "Okay." So we just sat there, and he snapped the photograph. That was it. But freshman year was it was tough. I mean, it shook my confidence in my own academic ability. At the end of the first semester, my GPA was 2.000. Flat C. And I knew I could do better than this. I just couldn't figure out what the hell was wrong. And what was wrong was I didn't have good study habits. And I had to teach myself good study habits. I had to learn what to listen for and what to read and what not to waste my time reading. I had to learn how to put down cogently on a piece of paper what my thoughts were so that they would make sense. I had a professor, Dr. Zucker, who taught first year English I had in my first semester as a freshman. Patton had just come out. It was a brand new movie. He told the class to go see Patton and write a critical analysis. So I went to see Patton. I wrote a critical analysis. He called me in. I think he gave me like C over D. And he explained to me how I had not put in the, I had not put on the paper what I intended to write. And I said, "Dr. Zucker, I'll be candid with you. I was of the impression that I wrote what I intended to write." He says, "Well, if this is what you intended to say, you can't write." And I thought to myself, "You son of a bitch." But that's kind of how the first year went. I mean, it was disappointment after disappointment after disappointment. And at the end of the first semester, halfway through the second semester, I mean, I wanted to transfer. No, that was the second year. Halfway through the first semester, second year, I really wanted to transfer out. And Walter Blake, who was a senior then, came over to the house that we lived in right down the street from the post office. And me, Morrison, Towns, we were all sitting in the basement and we were talking about transferring from W&L. And Blake must have talked to us for 3 hours to talk us into staying and not leaving W&L. And we stayed. And then Morris and I ended up not only staying through undergrad, but staying through law school.
What did Blake say to you? What was his reason?
He said, "Look, let me tell you something. You're smarter than you think you are. Don't let these people convince you that you don't know what you're talking about or that you don't know what you're doing." That he said, it's learning how to do it. Going to college is not like going to high school. You got to learn how to go to college. You got to learn how to do it. You got to learn how to maximize your time. Just because you spend 6 hours in the library at night, that doesn't mean a damn thing. If you spend 6 hours reading the wrong thing or studying the wrong thing, you got to learn how to identify what it is you're supposed to read and what it is you're not supposed to read. And one thing that took me, it took me some time to figure it out too was, and I told this to my daughter when she was getting ready to come up here freshman year. I said, "Well, let me tell you one thing. It took me about almost 3 years to figure this out in college. The key to it is this: find out as quickly as possible what you like, because college is about good liberal arts education. It's not about specializing for a job. It's about trying to broaden your own horizon and soak up as much as you can. So find what you like. Once you find what you like, find a professor who understands how you think, who can empathize with the way you write, and who sees life the way you see life. Take every goddamn thing he teaches. So don't go up there taking courses, take professors. That's what you got to do." And it took me about 2.5, almost 3 years to figure that out. And once I figured that out, that I wasn't preparing for a job, I was just trying to make myself better by trying to broaden my horizons, then all of a sudden things got better. Classes got easier, started to make more sense because I enjoyed what I was doing. But it took me a long time to figure that out. Blake was trying to tell me that and I just didn't hear it.
Who was that for you? Who were those teachers for you?
Dr. Merchant. He was a brand new professor when I was a freshman here, and I took his first history course. Dr. Merchant, Dr. Mosier, who taught history. Ken, can't remember Ken's last name. He taught sociology. Merchant won't remember his name. Dr. Kimbrough, who was the head of the sociology department when I was here, all the sociology teachers, Merchant and Mosier in the history department. Dr. Pleva down in the biology department. Dr. Heavyset guy, teaches chemistry. Walrus mustache.
Shillington?
Shillington, yeah. Those were tough courses, but they were good teachers. I mean, they were really patient teachers. I mean, they were good teachers. Mosier, more than anything else, taught me some lessons that I never forgot, and I don't think he ever realized he taught them to me. When I signed up for Mosier's Old South course, it was me, Matthew Towns, and Bobby Smith, three black guys. And we were sitting in class, and Mosier put us in alphabetical order, and it just so happens that all three of us ended up on the outside of the rows. And so when he realized what he had done, he basically told us, he says, well, if you're uncomfortable where you are, you can sit anywhere you want to sit. So I sat in the last row, last seat, in the very back. And one day he was lecturing on hangings and how in the Old South, hangings were public affairs, and they usually took place on Sunday after church, and people come from all over the county to watch a hanging, especially when it involved the hanging of a Negro. And I remember after class, went up to Dr. Mosier, and I was bent out of shape, and I told him that I didn't think it was appropriate to refer to black people as Negroes. And he says, well, how would you like, he says, I'm using the language of the times, how would you like to be referred to? And I said, as black. And we had to do these book reports. Every Monday morning, we had to turn in these book reports. He gave us this long damn bibliography that we had to read. And book reports could be anywhere from 2 to 5 pages. And the highest score you could get was a 4 on it. And so I turn in these book reports, and I get these 4s on all my book reports. And so one day he called me back after class, and he said, Mr. Hill, I read with great interest your book reports, and I find your views to be perceptive, but you seem to be extremely impatient with the progress that black people are making in America. And I said, well, Dr. Mosier, I'll be honest with you. My perspective is only some 19 years, and yeah, I'm impatient with it. And so he proceeded to tell me about this person he met. He said, let me tell you a story about the most intelligent man I have ever met in my life. And then he started explaining to me his first meeting with George Washington Carver. And I said, well, my dad used to tell me about George Washington Carver because Carver taught my dad when he was in Tuskegee. And my dad would tell me how Carver would come in the classroom in the morning and walk around and speak to all of his plants, touch them all, before he started his lectures. And how all the kids, all the students would crowd in to get to the front of the classroom because Carver never raised his voice when he talked. I mean, you know, talked in a low monotone. And Mosier and I started talking on a regular basis. And after a while, I started to like Dr. Mosier. And then I started to make the effort to talk to him. Asked, Dr. Mosier, can I talk to you after class for a minute? And I started to enjoy his company. And then this was my senior year. This was my first semester senior year. Second semester senior year, I had applied to law schools, and Dr. Mosier found out I had applied to law schools, and he said, Hill, I would really consider a privilege if you let me write a letter of recommendation for it. And so I asked him, would he mind writing one to Dean Steinheim, who's dean of law school? He said, no, I'd love to. So he wrote this letter of recommendation for me to Dean Steinheim. And this was Mosier's last year of teaching. He was retiring, and my parents came up for graduation, and he wanted to meet my parents. And Mosier gave me about 30 volumes out of his library, because he was getting rid of his books in his office. And I took them all home. I still got them all. When I graduated from law school 3 years later, Dean Steinheim said, Hill, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to recruit for the law school over at the Atlanta University Center. And I said, Dean Steinheim, as long as you're dean here at the law school, I'll recruit for W&L. And so he says, let me show you something. He said, I want to show you one of the best letters of recommendation I ever received for a student. He said, I've never shown it to you before, but I want you to read it. And it was a letter of recommendation from Dr. Mosier. And it was really a good letter. And what I learned from Dr. Mosier was, no matter what I do, I have to be very, very careful, because the human tendency to stereotype is so seductive. I mean, it happens before you realize you're doing it. And Dr. Mosier was tall and thin and distinguishingly gray with his real thick southern accent. I mean, he just reminded you of a Kentucky colonel. And at first I didn't like him, and I felt righteously entitled to not like him. And then slowly I began to understand that he truly was a young thinking man, that he was growing as I was growing too. And the lesson I learned, and to this very day, I am careful not to ever stereotype anybody. I'm not going to make a decision about somebody until I sit down and I talk to them and I know them as an individual. As far as I'm concerned, there are no groups of people. And that was a lesson I learned from Dr. Mosier I will never forget. And I don't know whether he even realized before he died that he taught it to me. But so my first year was tough, but it was a good year in the sense that it made me stretch a lot. And when I came back my second year, things started to change a little bit. At the end of my first year, I was happy to go home. And then somewhere along the line, wasn't really home anymore. And then by the end of my second year, W&L was home, and Atlanta was where I went for the summer. So, I mean, it just kind of changed on me. And I still come back to W&L because W&L, although it's not home because I live in Atlanta now, my family's there, my kids are growing up there, always come back to W&L to get grounded again. So.
What do you mean by that?
It is good to be in the company of people with a strong sense of duty and responsibility and honor and honesty. And W&L is not the real world. It is an academic environment where people enjoy academic pursuits, where in the list of priorities, things like the honor code and truth and intellectual integrity rate high. You step outside of W&L, out into the real world, into the business world, into the practice, and the rules of engagement are different. Honesty, intellectual integrity, and truth, they exist on the list of priorities, but they damn sure ain't in the top. They're kind of somewhere in the middle if you're lucky, and generally at the bottom if you're in a crisis situation. It's whatever is most expedient. It's situational ethics. And you constantly have to guard against being slowly seduced into that situation. When I first got on the bench, lawyers would come to you, and they'd say, "Judge, how you doing?" I'd say, "Fine." And they say, "You know, I was just in the courthouse, wanted to stop by and see you. I got two tickets to a play on next Saturday, and I'm not going to be able to make it. I just want to give you the tickets." And then I'd say, "I really appreciate that, Darryl, but I can't take them." "Well, I do this a lot of times for my judge friends. If I've got tickets I'm not using, I give them the tickets." I say, "I understand that, and I really do appreciate that, but I feel uncomfortable taking them. I truly do appreciate the gesture. I really do. But I can't take your tickets." I mean, and it starts off with little stuff like that, because he's going to appear before me in a case. He's going to want something like a favorable ruling on a motion, or he's going to want a continuance for 2 weeks because he's not ready for trial. And he's placed me in a position where I have to pause for a second, because 3 weeks ago he gave me tickets. I don't want to have to pause for a second. I want to do what I know is right and keep on moving. And you'd be surprised the number of people that are not at all dissuaded from taking tickets, free meals, vacationing at some lawyer's condo down in Jamaica, and then that same lawyer appears before that judge to practice, and the judge makes a substantial number of discretionary rulings that can go one way or the other. I mean, just maybe people get that type of ethical teaching somewhere else. I just happen to have gotten it at W&L.
Did you get it as an undergraduate as well as in law school?
Yes. And I got it in undergraduate as well as in law school. I don't know what the experience is for people who come to law school at W&L from somewhere else, because I went here all 7 years. But for me, it was most impressed on me in undergrad. When I got to law school, I didn't need to be taught that. I already knew it. So my focus was really on trying to learn how to practice. But for people who are just 3 year students in law school, maybe they have that same experience over that 3 year period of time. But and when I'm 18, 19 years old, I was much more impressed with the fact that students would leave their books laying around and they didn't get stolen. I mean, when I grew up in high school, people steal your your dirty Converse All-Stars out of your locker. Your tennis shoes be gone the next day. Some guy be walking up down the hall with your shoes on. And I got here and you didn't have to lock your room, your dorm rooms, anything like that. I mean, it was just, it made an impression on me. And so I like coming back because for me, it's a respite. It's an opportunity to get away and relax and be with people who truly have a common desire, which is to see the university do well, which is to pass along what they think they got from W&L to students here now, to talk to professors. I mean, it just feels good. I like coming back.
I want to go back to a couple of things you said. You're a wonderful interviewee, by the way. A long time ago, you mentioned, I want to get you back to those early days, that you all like to watch the news.
Yeah.
Why? I'm not aware of people around here being all that tuned into the news, except perhaps the journalism students.
Just to try and keep up with what was going on.
Were other students doing that, or were the black students doing
that? No, all the other students too. What we do is when we finish the labs down on the other end of the campus, we'd come over, we'd watch Wild Wild West, Star Trek, Danny Cronkite, and then we'd run to dinner. 5 days a week. That's what we do. And on Sundays, we'd watch Kojak Sunday night. We'd stop studying, come over, watch Kojak, and go back to the library. And that was it. That was the routine. But we'd always watch the news just to keep up with what was going on.
Okay. And how about fraternities? Were they an option for you?
No. Fraternities really weren't an option for us when we were students here. I think some of your least enjoyable encounters with other students happen at fraternity parties, at least for me anyway.
So, would you be willing to talk about that?
Well, I mean, you know, if two or three of us walked into a fraternity party, you just ignored. You get some beer. Maybe two or three or four of the guys would come over and talk to you. Nobody else would. I'm not assuming that there was a desire to exclude us. I'm simply assuming that there was apathy because there was no desire to include us. And so joining a white fraternity was not an option. My last year here at W&L, we started a chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha. And we had the chapter down in Blacksburg, and VPI was going to take us over. They needed 13 of us to start a chapter here. And I'll be very candid with you. I just could not get into the fraternity mentality. I mean, I just didn't like the group mentality. And I wanted to do things my way.
So where did you live? Freshman year, you were in the dorms.
Freshman year, we lived in the dorms. Sophomore year, we lived in the old Spee House right down the street from the post office. If you walk down to the post office, if you walk past the post office and straight down the street, you'll walk right into the house. I think it's still got that red door on it. We lived there my sophomore year and all my sophomore year. Our junior year, we moved off campus and moved into a house up on Massey Street. And then at the end of our junior year, our senior year, we lived in a house on Randolph Street, right across the street from the funeral home. So we lived in a dorm freshman year, the old Spee House sophomore year, Massey Street junior year, and on Randolph Street our senior year.
And we, meaning did all the black students live together?
When we lived down the street from the post office, it was me and Thomas Penn were roommates, and then Gary Avery was my roommate. And upstairs was Hutch, Bob Ford, Bobby Smith, and Matthew Towns, and John Morrison. Then when we moved...
Big house.
Mm-hmm. Then when we moved off campus onto Massey Street, it was me, Hutch, Penn, Matthew Towns, and Bobby Smith. the five of us. Then the same five of us moved into the house on Randolph Street.
Did you have any close white friends?
Yeah, I had friends who were white. They weren't really close. They weren't really close. And the thing about it is, I think, at least my perception, unlike the black students on campus now, when we were here, I think we felt not only drawn to each other, but pushed to each other. Not just internal attraction because we were so few of us, but also externally because for one reason or another, we didn't feel totally included in other activities. So we were pushed together, so we were close. And so we found a lot of the emotional and personal support that we needed to get through, we found it in the group. So there was not a real need for outside support. I suspect, just my observation as I walk around on campus now, that I don't know what the degree of the internal attraction is between minority students on campus, but I suspect they don't feel the external force pushing them together, so they aren't as cohesive as we used to be.
Eugene talked about having some white friends who were then ostracized by their fellow white students.
Oh, yeah. We had this white one guy, Harry Smith. I liked Harry. He was a good guy. He was the only white guy on the third floor of the old Spee House where we were all living our sophomore year. Harry was the only white guy upstairs on the third floor. And we were in the dining hall one day, and some white guy was giving Harry hell for hanging around with them niggas. And me and Philip Hutchinson, we were sitting, me, Hutch, and Matthew Towns, we were sitting in the dining hall eating dinner or lunch, and this white guy was giving Harry hell. I said, Hutch, you see that guy over there giving Harry hell? So he said, yeah, Harry can take care of himself. And so we were sitting there, and I said, if that guy swings on Harry, I'm going to go over there and jack his butt up. And so Hutch said, well, if he swings on Harry, we jack him up. Then the guy swung on Harry. Then we went over there and jacked this guy up, start turning over tables and everything. Mr. Darrell comes running out. And if you talk to Jared Darrell today, he'll tell you he remembers that fight in his dining hall. But Harry was a good guy. But yeah, he caught a lot of hell because he got along real well with us.
What was the outcome of that scene?
I don't think Harry had any more problems with him after that. But yeah, I mean, that happened. Now, I know the other guys had real good friends who were white too. Hutch was real good friends with a guy named Dean Golombeski. And Hutch died on Easter morning in Roanoke, just this past Easter. And I wanted to come to Hutch's funeral, and I was in the middle of a trial in federal district court, and I couldn't get out, and I couldn't come to his funeral. But I was talking to Penn, and I think Dean Golombeski flew in for Hutch's funeral. But I don't know. We had friends among ourselves that weren't necessarily friends in common with all the other black guys.
I need to turn the tape over.
Okay.